Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Newcastle County faces a tax increase along with spending cuts to erase a $42 million deficit.
I'm an optimistic person, and I know what I'm doing, and I have great staff to know what they're doing. We're actually figuring this out. We'll figure this out.
We asked Newcastle County Executive Marcus Henry how the county fell into a fiscal hole and about his plans to climb out of it. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a Court of Chancery judge's decision to reassign her cases related to Elon Musk. And our playlist previews a Calidore String Quartet performance at the University of Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, Newcastle County Executive Marcus Henry's budget address offered some sour fiscal news for the state's largest county. Henry says the county faces a $42 million deficit, and to fill it, he's proposing a 17.2% property tax increase, along with budget cuts and a hiring freeze. Earlier this week, I sat down with Marcus Henry to discuss Newcastle County's fiscal health and his budget proposal.
We're talking about the budget and a deficit you're trying to overcome.
Yes.
So let's start with how we got to this point. Several elements involved, but I want to start with a couple that perhaps could have been controlled. You noted in your budget address that one-time federal relief funds were used to cover recurring operating expenses, and reserves have been used to fund permanent costs. How much did these two factors, specifically to the deficit issue the county is facing right now?
Well, unfortunately, quite a bit, but also just escalation in some of our contracts. Salaries and benefits are the largest cost to the county. So we have escalation in terms of what's collectively bargained with our unions, mm-hmm. and that's part of that as well. But just to be clear, there's nothing wrong with using federal relief funds to help alleviate some of the operational cost. The issue is that we've been in deficit spending before I got into office for several years now. And once those federal relief dollars were no longer available to us, we had to look at ways to offset that deficit spending.
So using those federal relief funds and also dipping into reserves, I mean, it does to kind of kick the can down the road, doesn't it?
Which is what we're trying to avoid
right.
in doing this tax increase and doing this restructuring of our county government.
So how much of those issues, like kicking it down the road issues, fall on your predecessor, the current governor, Matt Meyer, and the you know, the previous county councils that signed on to that type of approach?
Well, I mean, to be honest, quite a bit. There were certain decisions that were made that are concerning to me looking at it in retrospect. One of them being not just with the federal relief dollars, but there was an increase back in 2024 mm-hmm. for the police salary compensation that was paid for at a tax stabilization reserve funds, which is not something you typically do to pay for operational expense. So that was like $8.5-9 million that came on to the operational budget when I took office, along with all the other increases that we've seen.
And also, your predecessor did create a one-time 5% tax credit in 2024 as well. That probably, in hindsight, didn't help the situation.
Didn't help at all, unfortunately. And it was almost, I think, about $6 million.
So there were other factors at work that you mentioned as well. One of them was this first property reassessment in 40 years, court ordered. Mm-hmm. The county kept its promise mm-hmm. of being revenue neutral, didn't bring any additional revenue in from it. But I guess the thing that also was a factor that maybe people didn't think about was the cost of conducting it
right.
seemed to prove more costly and actually now is going to require some ongoing costs.
Yes, yes. And part of it, too, is the scaling up of the staffing in the assessment office. Having the procedures and things in place to deal with the fact that it hadn't been 40 years had put a tremendous amount of strain on our assessment office. So scale up that staffing, deal with the logistics of just all the refunds, appeals, what have you, that the staff, I think, has done an incredible job dealing with. And also, you know, I'm happy to say we're scaling up the staffing over the last few months, and we'll continue to do that to meet this demand. The takeaway, though, for me, the main takeaway is you can't wait 40 years to do reassessment. That creates some of the issues that we experience right now. But I think the good news is that this helps us stabilize in terms of the property values of both commercial and residential so that the next reassessment should be much, much easier process for the public and for us.
Is there a sense of how much that wound up costing that you mentioned, the staffing up and just getting everything done and dealing with the appeals and things like that?
Well, there's a set aside, I believe, of about $20 million specific just to the reassessment itself. But we've gone $1.4 million in additional expense related to reassessment. Also, with the litigation the county was in, along with the school district, the school district, along with the county, was sued with regard to using a split tax rate. Mm-hmm. So settling that litigation, some of the additional requirements placed on New Castle County on the billing that affected both the county billing and we bill on behalf of the school district. So that additional expense, it's actually over $2 million, $2.5 million all in of additional expense.
So we've talked about a lot of different things here. It's almost like a perfect storm of a lot of little things adding
storm,
up.
A horrible storm, I would say.
Yeah, true. Fair enough. But there's also just the current state of the economy and inflation.
Sure.
That maybe just kind of complicates things even more.
Yeah, in the county, I mean, historically, we've been absorbing inflationary increases in our operational cost. We have not been passing that on to our constituents. That's something, you know, I think could have been looked at in the past in terms of maybe doing small incremental tax increases or adjustment in cost. Annualized would have helped the position we're in right now. This has been a long time coming. And unfortunately, under my administration, I'm dealing with that. But to me, it's to deal with it responsibly to cure this structural deficit that we're in so that we can create sustainability long-term for our county operations.
So let's move to that part.
Sure.
How to attack this deficit long-term. One piece, obviously, has drawn probably the most attention is the proposed property tax increase, 17.2%. How did you land on that number? What does that number signify in terms of getting the job done?
The number, quite frankly, is the exact amount we needed to cover the delta of this current budget. We had already reduced about $18.5 million off of this FY27 budget for reducing our operational expense. Coupled that with the 17.2 is exactly what we needed to balance this budget. We're still going to have difficulties in the near future, but it helps us stabilize things. But also, the need to work with the General Assembly on looking at diversification in terms of the revenue and sources of revenue that fund county operations.
And I know it's a tough ask at this point because of all the anger over reassessment. Obviously, a lot of the reassessment piece of things goes to the school taxes. That's not the county part of it, but you're wrapped up in that. How difficult is it to go out there and say to people, we need this 17.2%. We know you're already dealing with this. A lot of people are going to say, like, well, this is just unacceptable to me.
I understand that. I have a heck of a lot of empathy for those folks, especially seniors or those on fixed incomes. That's one of the things we're looking at is making sure we market and talk about specifically the various credits that are available to them, exemptions, to help them. But what I bear in mind is a couple of things. 69 cents of every county dollar spent towards public safety-related activities, primarily policing, but also 911 paramedic services that are critical to life safety in New Castle County. That's where these funds are going for. And then we look at the actual median household and the actual cost per household. It's a little over, it's a little less than $9 a month for this tax increase we're talking about. It's not a lot of money for some folks. I know some people we're going to try to work to help them. But I think it's reasonable in terms of the level of service New Castle County provides, especially in public safety, to ask for this now and to be reasonable about this.
You mentioned trying to help those who are going to have problems with this. Beyond kind of the already existing credits, are you looking for other ways to perhaps provide relief to people who need it?
We're going to look at some legislative initiatives that we'll work with council on, potentially look at that. Also, I think long term, we can also work with the General Assembly because, as we mentioned, 81% of the bills actually school districts, i.e. state, 19% the county. So if we can look at some coordinated relief, I think it'd be helpful to both the county and the state looking at those relief packages.
So looking at it like holistically for the taxpayer,
yes,
that you're going to help them with the school side, yes, and the county side.
One of the challenges, though, is we have, unfortunately, an antiquated billing system, which we're in the process of upgrading. And I think that'll help us in the future to help alleviate some of these concerns.
Another piece of this whole puzzle has been, as you've alluded to, cutting spending to deal with this. What are some of the, maybe the major areas that you've found savings to help bridge this gap?
Well, we looked at, I think it was like 56 or 57 positions, back office positions that we've defunded, meaning that they're not funded, including salary or benefits. If in the future, the financial picture improves, we can put those positions back online. But right now they're defunded. We reduced a lot of our special events, unfortunately, that I and a lot of folks enjoy. Reduce those special events because they're a pretty big cost to the county in terms of policing and public works activities. But we've also looked at savings in various areas in terms of efficiencies in the operations of our government. So this is $18.5 million. This hurts. The concern I had, one of the things I really wanted to focus on, was maintaining service delivery, maintain the level of service delivery in county government. So that's why we're strategic in terms of those cuts, but also being very specific about the amount of the tax increase.
You mentioned public safety. Are there some other areas in terms of services that you were particularly focused on preserving as best you could?
Paramedics, making sure we're staffing up paramedics, making sure we're staffing up our 911 operators, making sure that their salary structure is commensurate with the work that they're doing. One of the unfortunate realities we're having in emergency management systems in general is we have an aging population in that area, a lot of retirements over the last few years. Actually, a lot of retirements across the board in various departments of county government. So it's making sure that we hire, but also we train, and we don't lose that institutional knowledge that is lost when we lose that aged workforce.
You mentioned the positions that are defunded, what people have called a hiring freeze. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of positions those are? Like, which are the ones that are being defunded? You know, what is the loss there, I guess?
A lot of back office type positions, administrative type duties at various departments. Look, it hurts, but it's not something where it's public facing. It's not of a critical nature with respect to our operations, but it does make things more difficult in terms of our current staffing levels and the workload that a lot of our staff are doing across various departments. We all share this burden in county government. My office does, all our various departments do. So the hope is that we cure this structural deficit, we right-size things in terms of revenue so that we could staff up in the near future to alleviate some of these concerns. But right now we had to do this.
Was there any consideration of layoffs or salary cuts in this process?
I was against that because, one, we're collectively bargaining. About 84% of our workforce is unionized, and these are contracts that were negotiated. And I feel that there was a way to do this without layoffs. And I want to be fair to our county employees. They did not ask for this. They've been hardworking. I did not want to do this on the back of our employees.
You also mentioned public safety and the fact that that's a priority for you. Was there any discussion for looking for some savings there, even minimal ones, or was that just kind of a non-starter for you?
No, we have looked at some savings specifically in overtime and some other areas around public safety, policing in general. But when I ran for office, one of the things that was very important to me was to make sure we restore morale in the police department, that they're performing well, that they have strong leadership, and that I thought it was really a shame that they hadn't been close to their full authorized force in almost 10 years. I'm happy to say after this police graduating class that graduated last week, it's 40 new officers that still have to go through a level of training. We'll be closer just at our full authorized level for the first time in 10 years. That means more cops on the street and patrol. And I think it just makes everybody feel safer, especially in this climate we're dealing with right now.
I was going to say, that is probably, of all the things that the county provides, that is probably the corest of the core services.
Yeah, 415 authorized force with respect to police patrolling 500 square miles of unincorporated New Castle County, but also with jurisdictional agreements with other municipalities like Wilmington and Newark and Middletown. So it's a coordinated effort, and with the state police too, I should say. Mm-hmm. It's also important to mention that paramedic services, emergency services in southern New Castle County increased the service level of county operations to service southern New Castle County was important to me as well. And this budget helps in that regard.
One of the areas I think that people will notice some of the cutbacks in is with libraries. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going to go on with libraries, at least in the short term with this budget?
Sure. And I actually came from running libraries, my previous positions with county government. I love our libraries. They're nationally recognized in terms of their performance. What we're only talking about is closing one extra day a week. But that does mean that we'll have a library open somewhere within New Castle County every day of the week. We're just changing the public-facing opportunities for the public to come in the libraries. It's just reducing the operational expense by closing one day. but you'll always have a library available to you Monday through Sunday.
I bring it up because I've been having these conversations about libraries recently. Yep. Sussex County is looking at raising its library tax because they're dealing with what the state librarian Annie Norman said was kind of this, be careful what you wish for type of thing. They got a lot of money to expand and build, and now the operation of it has become more expensive. Is that something that you think about a lot in terms of going forward, how to make sure you can maintain the libraries with these kind of additional costs that have been brought on board?
Sure, and it's not a new issue for us. We've been dealing with that for some time. I think Sussex and other jurisdictions are seeing some of the expense now more than ever. For us, it's an important service we provide the public, not just books, but just these are community hubs and resources for people. And they're critically important because they're free. These are free services available to people. We're doing a public good here in terms of county government, and that public good has a cost to it. I think people are okay paying for libraries. I think people are okay paying for police and all these other initiatives because these are the core of what the county government does. I do have to mention a big part of this, too, which is not a fun subject but something that's necessary, is wastewater sewer treatment. This is hundreds of millions of dollars in operational and capital investment Newcastle County is responsible for. We have wastewater sewer treatment agreement with the city of Wilmington, for example, but also sewer expansion that may happen in unincorporated Newcastle County is the county responsibility. So when growth needs to happen, be it residential growth, commercial growth, new sewer capacity and sewer investment is responsibility of the county government. Well, guess what? There's a cost to that. But people want their toilets to flush. They want these services. They want the water to run the correct way. They want it treated the right way.
They want it to be clean.
They want it to be clean. And that's too critically important right now, honestly. And that's part of this budget, too, though.
When you were looking at the cut side of things, was there one thing for you personally that was particularly painful to say, yeah, we got to do that?
Some of the special events. I think we're looking at least for right now, Sleep Under the Stars, one of my favorite events that we have. There's just no way we can do that under the current budget climate. We'll look at other special events in the future. We're going to see what events we could keep or curtail, like scale them down a little bit. But that's where people kind of see directly their county tax dollars at work, and they enjoy these. They're family, fun, safe events. I don't like cutting any of these. But I'd rather, unfortunately, do that than lay off somebody or cut salaries. I think we could do both, and that hurts. But also, you know, our employees have worked so hard through my administration, through past administrations, and I think, unfortunately, just through social media, sometimes through the press, they've been blamed unfairly in terms of things that have transpired with county government. I want to make sure their morale is good, and they felt supported by my administration, by me directly.
Is that particularly in terms of reassessment?
Yes, especially in reassessment. I mean, look, folks are going to do what they're directed to do. They work very hard, do the best they can. But if you're understaffed, stressed, not given the resources, these things happen. It's not an excuse. That's why it's important to me have strong leadership. I have a new CFO in Dave Del Grande, a veteran who's done a heck of a job. He has great staff under him. And what I'm so proud of Dave is that he's restored that morale. And people, I mean, that's important in doing the day-to-day work. And I'm so happy with his performance to date.
Assuming all these things are approved by county council, how far will it take Newcastle County towards solving the structural budget issues? Could we be back here next year having a similar conversation?
I'm going to work my hardest not to avoid that. I think we have to be intentional. We, Newcastle County, working on our structural issues, working with the General Assembly. We need to create new diversified revenue for the level of service Newcastle County provides. We provide more direct service with respect to the public than Kent and Sussex does. We're just a different type of government. Well, there's a cost to that. We need to look at ways that we can get reimbursed for those level of service, dealing with policing, dealing with wastewater sewer treatment, dealing with all these things we've talked about. We're a large government, and I think we deserve and mandate consideration of those services and getting reciprocated for it through revenue.
Is there one or two of those diversification things that you are prioritizing when you go down to Dover and talk to the General Assembly?
Yeah, right now we're looking at specific cost recovery for some of the expenses related to the extra expenses related to reassessment. But I think one thing we do want to do long term is we actually, you know, and you know this, we collect the billing on behalf of the school districts. I think there's a way we can look at this where either we don't do that and the school districts take on that function, or there's some kind of cost allocation that we can get reciprocated for that service. I would lean more towards the school districts doing their own billing. I think that would help.
In an op-ed you recently penned, we'll finish with this, you said, after 14 months in office, I've learned something that every honest leader eventually confronts. Sometimes the responsible decision and the popular decision are not the same thing. Do you think about all the implications this approach could have for you, specifically 2 years from now when you're back up for election?
Yes, but let me say it like this. I didn't run for office just to worry about my reelection. I came into office to fix these things in county government. I knew we'd be facing some challenges. If I do the best job I can and I help this government stabilize and all these services expand, like affordable housing and economic development and responsible land use, if I accomplish all these and for whatever reason I don't get reelected, I'm okay. I'm not going to like it. I want to get reelected like anybody else. But, you know, you have to – this is public service. Mm-hmm. This is public service. And I have to be frank, I think some elected officials fail to realize that. I think about that every day I wake up. Every day I wake up, am I putting my best foot forward? And if I say yes, and I can look at my kids and my wife and they see that, I'm working very hard to make this the right way.
Are you optimistic that it will look better in 2 years? And are you optimistic?
Oh, less than that. No, we'll be fine. We'll be okay.
And are you optimistic with...
I'm an optimistic person, and I know what I'm doing, and I have great staff to know what they're doing. We're actively figuring this out. We'll figure this out.
And with county council, do you feel optimistic that your relationship with county council is going to work?
I believe so. We have some work to do, but they're reasonable people. We just have to work together. And some of them have been around for years. They understand this process as well. Work together. Solve problems. That's what people elect us for. And that's what we're going to do.
Thanks to Newcastle County Executive Marcus Henry for joining us on The Green this week. Henry will hold 4 town hall meetings on his budget proposal. The first is Tuesday, April 7th at the Appaquinimink Library. Dates and times for the others are available at The Green's page at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, we learn more about the implications of a Court of Chancery judge's decision to reassign cases she was slated to hear involving Elon Musk in the wake of bias allegations. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for staying with us. On Monday, March 30th, Chancellor Kathleen McCormick, the highest judge on Delaware's Court of Chancery, made an uncommon filing. She was originally set to preside over 3 lawsuits against Tesla CEO Elon Musk, but last week his lawyers accused her of showing bias over a LinkedIn post she allegedly liked. In her filing this week, McCormick refused to recuse herself but reassigned the 3 lawsuits to others on the Chancery bench. To understand what this means, Delaware Public Media's Jay Shaw spoke with Lawrence Cunningham, director of the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware.
The situation was that the a party to the lawsuit, Mr. Musk, observed a social media post that was apparently supported by the chancellor's, that's the judge, Chancellor McCormick's account. And it was in the post that it was associated with was a post critical of Musk in a California case that has some underlying facts in common with the Delaware case. So Musk's lawyer said that's a sign that the chancellor has a thumb on the scale, you know, a bias against Mr. Musk. And whenever that happens, whenever a party perceives that the judge in his case is biased in some way, it's common for the party to make a motion to that judge to ask the judge to recuse herself from the case, meaning she no longer sits on it and the case gets handed to a different judge. And so that's what the defendants, that's what Mr. Musk and his lawyers did on Monday of this week.
Right. And why is this particular situation different than usual? I mean, it's not a new thing for a plaintiff or defendant to set this motion or bring this motion to a judge and ask for a different judge. In most cases, there are recusals when there are, you know, real allegations, when there are grounds for bias or conflict of interest. But he or she reassigned the cases. So can you just talk about why that matters?
Yes, it's a very interesting decision that the chancellor issued this week on Wednesday, because she read the papers, read the argument, I guess, you know, looked into the background facts, you know, did her own investigation.
You mean Monday, right? Not Wednesday.
Yeah, I think on Monday that was the filing. Did her letter, let's see, her letter, I think, came out
last week.
Oh, it was yesterday that her letter is dated yesterday. So
okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And her decision is fascinating because it says your premise of bias is flatly wrong. I am not biased. And as evidence, she said, incidentally, I ruled for this client in another matter recently. So she denied the motion to recuse, but she granted a motion to reassign the case anyway. So it's a very interesting ruling. Usually in Delaware and other states, it's one or the other, that the judge says, I'm not biased and I'm keeping the case, or you're right, I'm biased, or it might look like I am, so I'm reassigning mm-hmm. the case. She did something quite interesting, which said, I am not biased. The premise is wrong, but I'm nevertheless reassigning the case because, she said, otherwise this will attract undue media attention that is not in the best interest of justice or the courts or the system.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating ruling in that way. It's, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And for this particular situation, would there be any implications for Judge McCormick to reassign those cases versus completely recuse herself or, you know, continue presiding over these cases?
Yeah, what she's done is said, I'm legally, I'm not recusing myself because it's a two-pronged test that says either a judge is actually biased or the circumstances could lead a reasonable observer to mm-hmm. believe that she is. And so she said neither of them is true.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, in the interest of institutional integrity and not turning this into a circus, I'm going to reassign it, all three of those cases, I guess each to a different judge.
Right.
And we have a mechanism in Delaware that she'll use. I think they actually just spin a wheel. They conduct some sort of lottery. They just pick a name out of a hat, basically.
Like a bingo thing.
Yes. And it's called the random assignment method. And it's actually relatively new in Delaware. They just put it in. It used to be that the chief judge, the chancellor, would make assignments that, oh, here's a case that I think this vice chancellor would be particularly good at handling. The chancellor used to hand those out. But just this past year, the chancellor just changed that approach. And now they use this random system so that these three cases that she's going to reassign will be put into that system and they'll be assigned to three different vice chancellors, which is another neat thing.
Interesting.
She emphasizes in her opinion, I think it's a really valuable point to make, that, you know, there are very good vice chancellors in Delaware. So it's not as if it's a court, it's an institution. It's not a personality, you know, it's not a person. So she expresses great confidence in the other vice chancellors to take up this work.
Yeah. And I guess if she had handpicked specific vice chancellors to hand these cases to, then they probably would have had even further grounds for saying, oh, you're going to hand these cases to someone who's going to rule on them like you would, who would have the same opinions and biases like you would. So having that randomized lottery, in a sense, makes that alleged conflict of interest less of a possibility.
Exactly.
Right. So this isn't her first case involving Elon Musk, and Musk has publicly criticized her in the previous two cases with posting about it on his social media accounts. Does that matter with regards to the way she responded to his lawyer's allegations for these three cases this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the context is important, and the lawyers in their papers making the motion referenced those other cases as the broader context in which Mr. Musk perceives judicial bias, and mm-hmm. so they're advocating that position on his behalf, and he did lose two cases in this court. Mm-hmm. One of them was later overturned, but he did lose two big cases. But you know, right. all cases are won and lost. So I'm not sure on its own if that's evidence of bias. What the chancellor did in her letter about the reassignment and the recusal is she put a footnote in saying, I'm not biased against these defendants. In fact, I dismissed a suit against another case. I dismissed mm-hmm. a case just last summer. So it's important context, but I think the real focus in this instance is that social media issue that you started with.
Yeah. So in terms of that, then, is it, regardless of whether there's social media involved or not, is it legally, morally, and or ethically binding for Judge McCormick to reassign these cases instead of recusing herself entirely?
That's a wonderful question. And my reading of the sort of the jurisprudence of what she did, right, the philosophy of her opinion, it's a very brief opinion. It's just a couple paragraphs.
Yeah.
It's actually, to me, it's quite impressive because by denying the recusal motion, she sort of protects the doctrine. There's no disturbance. The law of recusal in Delaware is the same as it's ever been before and after this opinion, no real change. And that sort of protects the doctrine. But then by
what is the law? What is the doctrine?
Oh, the doctrine is it's part of the Code of Judicial Ethics in Delaware and really in all states and federal courts. And it says that a judge shall recuse herself from a case if either she is biased against or for one of the parties, or if a reasonable person aware of all the facts might perceive that person to be biased. So it's an either or, and if either of those things is true, the judge shall recuse herself. It's part of the Code of Judicial Conduct.
Right, and them being reasonable is kind of key, being a reasonable person.
Yep, it's they call it an objective test, you know, so it's not actually you or me, it's this mythical creature who's just looking at stuff.
Right.
And another key word, in addition to reasonable, is might. Because sometimes those sort of objective observer standards are whether a person would see some sort of problem. Here it's whether a person might. So it's a very protective, I mean, the purpose of these recusal provisions or ethics is really to protect the judicial branch of government. Like, it's got to be seen as independent and impartial, you know, balancing the blind, the scale of justice with the blind eye. Like, that's what is, it's so important. So that law is pretty strict. And I think her opinion, it sustains that, right? She doesn't grapple. She mm-hmm. says, I am not biased. I haven't changed the law. Mm-hmm. Then shifts to this other and says, look, but I appreciate that in this context with the multiple cases that have been through here, they're all high profile. It would be better for the court and the case and the system mm-hmm. to reassign these cases to mm-hmm. another person. And so it's in some ways that's a Solomonic disposition of the motions.
Yeah. So she does cover. She's not doing anything illegal here. She's trying to think from an ethical standpoint and also a moral standpoint, because she's maintaining her denial of bias, but she doesn't want to draw attention away from the justice system. And so she's decided to reassign these cases via this randomized lottery. But in your view, on the other side, I'm playing devil's advocate here, would it have been better for her to recuse herself?
Well, in order to do that, she, I mean, it gets into a thicket. I think it would have been, if not mandatory, certainly expected to then explain in detail why this appearance exists and, you know, get into the background of what were those social media posts, what LinkedIn mechanisms were used to signal, and it just probably a thicket that would realize the concern she expressed, right? That it's like, oh, this is a really big media story.
Here.
So I think, look, it's hard to, it's a very hard case, you know, issue to decide. So I think, and I always give courts the benefit of the doubt. So I think it's a wise ruling. And, you know, I don't know, you know, how a defendant or a law firm would feel about an outcome like this, but to me it seems like a good outcome for them, because their goal mm-hmm. was to get a different judge. Mm-hmm. So they got a different judge, and you know, right. whether they win some, you know, boxing contest about, you know, it's like, good, okay, now they can get on and, you know, look at the merit. If they are right that they were in a biased courtroom, now they'll get the strikes and balls, you know, just called objectively, and that should satisfy them, I would think.
Thanks to Lawrence Cunningham, director of UD's John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance, and RJ Shah for tackling this issue on The Green this week. You can listen to more of this conversation on The Green's page at delawarepublic.org. And we close out this week's show next with Arts Playlist, where Martin Matheny looks ahead to the Calidore String Quartet's performance at the University of Delaware. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. For almost 10 years, the University of Delaware has played host to the Calidore String Quartet. In addition to a busy performing and recording schedule, the ensemble teaches the next generation of classical musicians through their work at UD. This Monday, the quartet presents a performance at UD centering on music by Mozart. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by one of the group's violinists, Ryan Meehan.
Let me start by asking you about the history of this group and some of the really amazing things that you've done.
Sure. We formed in 2010 in Los Angeles, where we were all in school at the Colburn School. And we all had this like-minded passion for playing string quartet. And we decided we wanted to take it seriously, and we did. They have lots of competitions for music. I know it seems silly, but they can be very helpful sometimes in helping to get your work out there and to share it with larger audiences. So we did 7 competitions in the first 2 years that we were playing together, and that also helped us to learn the repertoire that kind of formed the core of our identity. And getting to know each other through all of this different repertoire in such an intense way was very, very helpful for us, and kind of unified our commitment to one another and what we were trying to achieve. And that helped us to start playing concerts. And one thing led to another. And we met the Emerson Quartet, the preeminent quartet of the later half of the 20th century and 21st century, and they just retired. And that meeting was very fortuitous, because they taught at Stony Brook University out on Long Island, and they invited us to come there to do a special program just to study with them. So that's when we moved from Los Angeles to New York City, and then we auditioned for a program at Lincoln Center, part of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And so that kind of anchored us then there after school in New York, and we continued to travel other places, but that formed a really important part of what we were doing artistically. And it was through all of that, actually, that we came to know the former president of the University of Delaware. And when he came from Stony Brook to Delaware, he wanted to create something similar to what was going on at Stony Brook. He saw it as a very vital part of the university's life and culture of the community. And so that was the beginning of our relationship with the University of Delaware, and that was in 2017.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about some of the repertoire on this concert. What will you be performing?
Sure. This is centered around works by Mozart, as particularly his clarinet quintet, his only clarinet quintet, and we could not have a better partner for this piece than Ricardo Morales, the principal clarinet of the Philadelphia Orchestra, truly one of the greatest clarinetists in the world. And he's a close friend of ours, and this will be our first time collaborating together, so we're very excited about this. Also on the program is one of Mozart's late quartets, also known as the Prussian quartets, and these feature really prominently the cello, which was very unique for the time. And so our cellist Estelle Choi will be playing very beautiful high melodies throughout the Mozart quartet. And in between, we have a short piece by Hugo Wolf, and this is called the Italian Serenade. It's a very exciting, slightly quirky little piece to just kind of split up the two large pieces by Mozart.
For audiences, what makes listening to live chamber music such a special experience?
Yeah, I think it's, I can speak to what got me really passionate about it is the element of conversation that's happening on the stage. We have no conductor. We have to show and give cues and feel the music completely through our own sound and body language. And so when you watch chamber music live, it is as much a visual experience as it is auditory. You really can see how we have to live, breathe every moment of the music together so that we can continue to play together, but also to make the music in the same way so that we can create a unified message.
You talked a little bit about the communication, sort of the nonverbal communication on stage, and I'm wondering about the rehearsal room because you've got four world-class musicians. Everybody has deeply held musical opinions. So how do you, as an ensemble, go from four interpretations into one?
Yeah, that's really the million-dollar question. It was definitely a more drawn-out process when we were younger, because really we were coming from four completely different backgrounds. Though we went to the same school and we held some similar kind of standards for ourselves because of our training there, it did take a lot of verbal mediation sometimes in order to come to a consensus. But very often, every group's a little different. I would say our group, if we hit an impasse about a musical idea, we often would say, let's just leave it for today, let's go do other things. And we would come back the next day being much more open-minded, and usually we found some kind of middle ground between the two ideas that really spoke to all of us. And these days, I would say we can do a lot less verbal kind of breakdowns of what the issue is or why we're not agreeing, and we kind of just play it for each other. Like, I hear it this way and you hear it that way, let's try it this way and let's try it that way. That's another kind of golden rule we have, is that anybody's idea at any time, we just try it. We don't try to shoot it down before it's even been delivered musically. I mean, I can speak for myself. Sometimes I hear my own idea in reality. It sounded good in my head, but then I hear it in reality and I'm happy to say, oh, actually, I don't like it anymore. But I think the idea that we try everything makes everybody feel comfortable to share their ideas, and it results in a better product in the end.
You mentioned your work at University of Delaware and you teach there. So for people who are perhaps a little bit worried about the future sustainability of art music, tell me what your teaching work is telling you about the next generation of classical musicians.
Yeah, we always hear this thing, classical music is dying. I've been hearing it since I was a kid. And it's remarkable to me that just every generation, one after another, there are just thousands of young people who are just completely in love with the art form, and they want to go to school and dedicate their whole lives to practicing 5 or 6 hours a day their instrument to create music with other people. And that is completely inspiring. And what I see at Delaware is no exception. We have such a wonderful school of music. We have award-winning vocal department and chamber music department and just so many great things going on and across all of the different instrument groups. We work specifically with the graduate string quartet in residence. So they are a group that we recruit every 2 years. This particular group this year is called the Prometheus Quartet. They graduated with their master's degree already as a quartet from the Juilliard School, and they came. Now they're in their end of their first year studying with us, and we give them very intensive weekly coachings. We also mentor them individually on their instruments, so violin lessons, viola lessons, cello lessons. And they're a remarkable group, and they work with such dedication and such passion for the music that it is inspiring for us as the teachers, reminding us why we do what we're doing. Just the kind of tireless commitment that they bring. And I am confident that this will continue on to eternity, that people will find this music speaks to their innermost feelings, the things that they have trouble maybe sometimes verbalizing what it is, and the music seems to say it. And this act of discovery will continue on and on and on for generations.
Last month, you released a new record, American yes. Tapestry, works by Samuel Barber, Wynton Marsalis, John Williams. Tell me the works that you're playing and also how you chose this particular lineup of music.
I think the idea began in two ways. We were very passionate about the music of Eric Wolfgang Korngold and how for so many years and decades, his music was kind of avoided on the concert stage. And of course, his violin concerto is very famous now, but so much of his other work is underplayed, and that there was this sentiment that a movie composer cannot be a classical composer. But in fact, he was a classical composer first and was very celebrated as a child prodigy in his time in Vienna. But then he came to America and he came to Los Angeles, and that was another reason, the connection to LA that got us thinking. And he won many Academy Awards and basically became John Williams before John Williams. And we had the occasion to meet John Williams, and we were playing in a ceremony of remembrance for his friend Andre Previn, and he spoke at this event, and we met him, and then we asked him if he might write something for us, and he presented us with an arrangement of a work from his movie Lincoln. The piece is called With Malice Towards None. And with these two kind of pieces, the third quartet of Korngold and this in our repertoire, as well as on a very separate note, we were introduced to this work by Wynton Marsalis at the Octoroon Balls, his first string quartet. Of course, we're huge fans of him in general as a musician, but didn't know that he had written a string quartet, and we heard it and we fell in love with it and we played it a lot. And we started to think about all these three pieces well, and also the 250th anniversary of America's coming up, so we decided to do an American album. Of course, you can't have an American album without considering Samuel Barber and his incredible Adagio for Strings, which is actually part of his first string quartet. We often hear the orchestra version, but this is the original version. And so piece by piece, the program kind of came together, and we named it American Tapestry because it really was like something that we wove together from different strings. And I think it's an exploration of the diverse origins of American classical music culture, and also exploring, you know, what is the sound of America. A lot of people comment within classical music, you know, oh, you have a they say to us very often, oh, it sounds like you're American. Well, we always wonder, like, what does that mean? Where does it come from? And so I think these pieces helped us explore the various facets of an American sound.
Thanks to Calidore String Quartet violinist Ryan Meehan for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Calidore String Quartet performs at UD this Monday at 5:30. And for more of Martin Matheny's interview with Meehan, including what it's like to play on a near-mythical Stradivarius violin and how he handles frustration in the practice room, listen to the full-length interview at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and our producer, Jay Shaw. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.